My dulcet tones didn't have the effect that the bell did. Now, we've got some more staff members joining us here. We have Nick and Michael from the FASB, so welcome, guys. You couldn't get up so early this morning, or what happened?
We can't hear you.
We can't hear you. Press it again.
There. Technical difficulty. We were here.
Yeah, Nick, I'm a standard setter. I'd believe anything. And also, on the ISB side, I neglected to introduce everybody else. Ada's going to tee up the lesser accounting side of things. And we have Jess, some here, Sarah, and Lily somewhere. And Henry, in the very modest pink shirt there, who has oversight responsibility.
Yeah, red socks.
And red socks.
Red socks.
Unlike Tatsumi in one of the early board meetings, turned up with a pair of Playboy socks. I don't think he's got them on today. You're very welcome. Yeah, I know. It's very sad, isn't it? Okay. Ada, would you like to tee up the discussion on lessor accounting?
Thanks, Warren. Good afternoon, everyone. We know you have lots to say on lessor accounting, so I'm going to be very, very brief. You didn't like much what was proposed in the ED, nor did pretty much anyone. So it is not a topic we have yet brought to the board, but it is something we are discussing in education sessions this week. So you may or may not have a chance to see those papers. They were posted, I think, quite late, end of last week. But basically, everything is up for grabs in terms of we are asking for decisions going back to basic principles. So we will be asking the boards whether one or two approaches for lessor accounting are appropriate. If there is one approach, which approach it is. If there are two approaches, would approach for other than finance leases be more similar to current lease accounting, operating lease accounting, or more similar to performance obligation as proposed in the ED, and would approach for finance type leases be more similar to partial derecognition approach proposing the exposure draft, or should it be more akin to the current accounting, which is a full derecognition approach? We are not discussing separately the indicators, which is something we covered already in the discussion on the C accounting, but of course, to the extent you have differing views on those, please give us that. So I would just like to turn over to you for your comments and discussion.
Okay, so tell us, you've told us we've got it wrong, so what should we do on lessor accounting then? How can we write it? Yeah. Okay, Kevin.
Being not a lessor, it's easy.
I have a problem with the derecognition approach, like the other guys. And principally, if I use the example that's in 1D that we discussed this morning on tugboats, at initial recognition, the guy who's going to be transporting that coal, he's only got this one contract. And therefore, he thinks that he will derecognize because he intends to utilize these tugboats in total fulfillment of that contract. And it's a five-year contract. If after 2 years he obtains another, and there was substitution availability in that original contract, but it was irrelevant because substitution with no idea of how you're going to substitute wouldn't pass an indicator test. 2 years later he gets another contract, and now the substitution comes in. But he's derecognized day one. How do we deal with this subsequent reassessment on what has potentially been a derecognized asset?
So is it in those
undo the profit, I think.
Is it in those circumstances that particularly worry you?
That's the ones that particularly worry me, because it's subsequent assessment. You know, if we're going to ban reassessment, that doesn't make sense, because that's not the way of the world. The guy who's got the use of the assets mm-hmm. is able to use them, will always have substitution available.
So what should the lessor do in those circumstances?
Well, I just don't think derecognition can ever pass the test at the lessor.
Yeah, but my question is, so what then would you do? Performance obligation.
Performance obligation.
Okay.
Single assets, I understand. But once you start bundling assets together into a single contract, I don't see how you can ever pass derecognition.
Bill, did you come in?
No. I was going to say, is it even a lease?
Well, exactly.
Well, I think he said it was. It's you've got.
Well, I used the example that they had in that tugboat.
Yeah, but you said that the lessor could use that lease, that asset, to deliver product for other people.
But he had no other contracts on day one.
Yeah, but still, he's in the business of providing a service. I don't think he has a lease.
Yeah, I mean, you'd obviously need to look at. I thought you'd teed it up so that, you know, even though there were perhaps substitution rights, that wasn't significant and
it wasn't
substantive, but it could happen, and if it did, what would you do then?
Yeah.
I think that was your point. Now, Kevin, Mark, you were next, sorry.
Yeah, all I wanted to say is that I don't agree with Kevin at all in his interpretation of the towboat example. If the guy only has one contract, then he's a start-up towboat operator, and he may not be using his towboats to full capacity at first, but he's going to go out and look for a second and a third and a fourth contract. And he, to me, is a service provider. He's invested in some towboats, he's found his first customer, but if for his business to work, he's got to go out and find some more. I mean, nothing in that example said that that was the only contract that he had. So, you know, I don't agree with you on that. He hasn't got a lease because he's a service provider.
Yeah, you're saying the business model approach is the one, therefore, that should be used. And I'm going from an audit perspective. How do I know whether I've got a derecognition principle? Because there is nothing else. Is the auditor going to be allowed to adopt a performance obligation? Is the auditor going to conclude I can adopt a performance obligation approach on the basis that you might be able to get one or two or three more contracts?
Yeah, but I think that's a discussion with the auditors as to what that person's business is. But I think his business is providing coal transportation services, not being a lessor of towboats. And if he expresses his business as being that and the auditors agree with him, then you don't have an issue around derecognition or performance obligation. You simply have someone who's providing services and accounting for them as he gets paid for them. I wanted to ask your question, Warren, about what should you do about lessor accounting. You should do derecognition for everything. And you should ban any mention of performance obligation anywhere in the lessor accounting literature. It would be my position.
I see you on back to Paris.
And we haven't had a conversation before, have we?
No, but performance obligation, now you know what I think, that performance obligation just doesn't fit with the facts and the economic realities of these deals. And I think that derecognition, provided there's accretion of the residual value, works in virtually all circumstances. And if you look at the circumstances where we know it wouldn't, there are two circumstances where it doesn't work very well. One is on very short-term leases, sort of short-term car hire, because you really don't want to have people de-recognizing 4 hours of rental twice a day or de-recognizing a weekend's rental every Monday morning and so on. But basically, lessor operating lease accounting works quite well for those. And really, what your depreciation is in there is a proxy for a series of regular de-recognitions. And it's just simpler than de-recognizing each small rental agreement over time. The other issue where derecognition seems to be doesn't work that well is on real estate, and it certainly doesn't work well for those who have the historic cost option under IAS 40. But the answer to that is simply to leave investment property accounting unchanged, to leave IAS 40 as it is. I don't think it's broken on the lessor side. And the other thing I wanted to say is a lot of people say lessor accounting isn't broken, so why not change it? It may be true that lessor accounting isn't broken at the moment. But why isn't it broken? It's because it's coherent and consistent with lessee accounting. But if you change lessee accounting, by changing lessee accounting, you're going to break lessor accounting. And that's why you need to deal with lessor accounting at the same time. As it stands today, yeah, maybe it's not broken. But tomorrow it will be, because it won't be consistent with a lessee right of use model.
Stay on that line there. Larry, you want to come in?
So help me understand this. One of the proposals that Kristen talked about for lessee accounting was effectively to stay on IAS 17. All right. So if we did that, so the major change in practice was that instead of getting operating lease accounting off the balance sheet, you now have operating lease accounting on the balance sheet. That's the fundamental difference. So if we kept that, what would happen? What would be your proposal for lessor accounting?
If you put a right of use on the lessee's balance sheet, you're therefore saying that he has purchased something. Somebody sold it to him. That's the lessor, so he should de-recognize what he sold to him.
But we're not accounting for the books of the world. We don't need to have, the fact that somebody put something on the balance sheet, somebody else has to take something off the balance sheet. There is no consolidated worldwide set of financial statements. But if you keep the exact same rules that you had, the only difference being you're putting one on the balance sheet, but the determination as to what dictates your accounting remains the same as it is today, why do you need to change lessor accounting?
Because it just doesn't make you can't generate the spontaneous creation of new assets. If as a lessor I have bought, whether I already owned it or I've owned it for an instant of time before I lease it to a lessee, when you own an asset, you own all the rights and obligations that go with that asset. You have the right to use it, to transform it, to sell it, whatever. When you lease it, under the right of use model, this is in, the board's right of use model, you're taking part of those complete ownership rights, which is the right to use it for a period of time, and you're transferring it to somebody else. You're therefore reducing the value that that asset has to you. And all I'm saying is that you need to recognize that in your accounting somewhere.
But all I'm saying is that the legal rights and obligations pursuant to your lease contract have not changed one iota if we were to adopt Alternative A or the IAS 17 model for lessee accounting. So why needs there be a corresponding change to lessor accounting? It's just...
But it's simply because
there are no change in the rights and obligations associated with the lessor who owns that piece of equipment or what have you.
Of course there are. He can't use the asset anymore. That's like if I said to you, Larry, that's a very nice Jaguar you've got parked out front. Can you let me use it for the next 4 years?
The agreement is the same.
But I think you're talking past one. All he's saying, Larry, is that if under the model that may become the revised leasing standard, we have the right of use in the other than finance lease category being recognised as an asset rather than being off balance sheet, then not to have symmetrical accounting on the lessor side doesn't seem to make sense. That's all he's saying. And I think all you're saying is...
We're not accounting for the books of the world.
But that's exactly what you're saying. But coming back to... If I can just sort of take Larry's point in a slightly different direction... I'm not quite clear what your line of separation is. Leave aside the property leases, and you said, well, just let 40 deal with that, and FASB's doing something in that area as well. So you're talking about these maybe shorter-term leases, the motor vehicle lease-type situation. What would be your line of separation then in terms of, from a lessor viewpoint, when you get just the sort of the ongoing operating lease accounting compared to derecognition? Is it like a 12-month thing, or I'm trying to...
I think fundamentally that it should actually just be down to the choice of the lessor as to what he thinks reflects best his the contract, or his business model, but his business model for that type of contract. I don't see why you don't give a free choice to the lessor, to be honest. The lessor knows whether what he is doing is closer to financing that right of use and taking a credit risk on the lessee. So that's one end of the spectrum. The other end of the spectrum is that he is taking asset risk and hoping that he can lease and release sufficiently often the asset to earn back the purchase price. And I think lessors know very well which of those two business models they're in. One is much more suited, the asset. We've had this conversation in a previous working group meeting about asset managers and asset financiers. I think lessors know which side of the line they're on because they deliberately choose it as a matter of policy, and that therefore they can choose which, whether they use operating lease accounting or derecognition accounting. And I'm not sure that you have to actually give yourself a major headache by trying to define the dividing line.
Okay, I understand. Rich, thanks.
Just an observation. Every time we get to a difficult issue so far today, we said the auditors will work it out. I'm not sure that's going to be the most popular solution in the room, so I encourage the standard setters maybe to work those issues out first. I actually think if we're going to encourage two models for lessees, there probably ought to be two models for lessors, and I don't necessarily see a different dividing line, whatever you pick for that differentiation between, I'll call them on-balance sheet operating leases and finance leases, I think makes sense. I think the issue then comes down to profit recognition. And when are we comfortable with upfront profit recognition? And I would think we'd be comfortable with it. In the same instance, we'd be comfortable with it in a sale. But to do that, I think you have to define what we're selling. And is it the right to use the asset, or is it the asset? I would assume that upfront recognition would have to meet some hurdle for the asset itself, not simply the right to use. But that would be, you asked me to lay out what we think, that would be what I think. The other issue is I'm apparently behind you guys a bit because I thought the lessee was accounting for the right to use the asset, not the asset. And if it's the right to use the asset, I guess you could have the lessee recognize that without the lessor de-recognizing the asset because we're not accounting for the asset. We're accounting for the contractual rights. But to me, that seems like a fundamental issue that we'd have to get everybody over. It's either the asset or the right to use the asset to figure out whether it should be de-recognized or not. I think if you use the current type definition for other than finance lease and finance lease cutoff, maybe that's the right point where you start accounting for the asset and derecognizing. That can make some sense. But I don't know how to do upfront profit recognition right now because I think that does definitely need to be aligned to the REVREX standard. I think if we don't, we're going to end up with people flipping back and forth between lease transaction and seller financing transactions if it gives you different upfront profit recognition, just as an observation.
Now, I just wanted to say to Rich on his point about are we accounting for the right to use the asset or the asset. I think that the boards are asking us to look at accounting for the right to use the asset, but the right to use an asset is clearly part of the value of that asset. An asset, a car, building or whatever, its intrinsic value as an object is probably pretty minimal. I mean, you could, you know, a car, you could sell it for scrap or whatever. Its real value is in the ability to use it to go from A to B. And if you've given that ability to use it to somebody else, then you've sold the right to use the asset and therefore part of the value of the asset. Because the whole premise behind the right to use model, it seems to me, is that an asset is a bundle of rights and obligations and that you're disposing of some of them. If I've got that wrong, then I've been misunderstood for the last 3 years.
I think you've got that right in terms of the conceptual underpinning of a derecognition approach. The performance obligation approach took a different view, and it's a matter of when you satisfy your performance obligation. And I think under the performance obligation approach, you have to continue to provide that asset over the term of the lease. And as you provide the asset, you are meeting your performance obligations continuously. Whereas I think in the derecognition approach, it's exactly as you said, you've met your performance obligation once you've delivered the right of use and you derecognise essentially the value or the proportion of the carrying amount that's attributable to what you've transferred.
I would add is that I think that the derecognition approach is consistent with the right of use, the notion of right of use, and that's where performance obligation falls apart, because it's not consistent with the right of use concept on them. If you have fundamentally you've come at this project from the notion of there being a valuable asset which is the right of use, if you accept that one accepts the premise that there is something called the right of use which has value and can be extracted, separated from the rest of the asset, then I don't see how you can justify performance obligation, under performance obligation, considering you still have the full value of the asset and that it's not impaired in any way. I mean, that's why, to me, performance obligation just doesn't make sense. I mean, added to which the fact that having an ongoing obligation to make something available when you've delivered it and the contract says that you have to give the lessee quiet enjoyment, that's just saying you have an ongoing obligation to respect your contract. I don't think that ongoing obligations to respect contracts, like ongoing obligations that we all have to respect the law of the land, that they're not liabilities. They just don't meet the definition of a liability, which is why I say that performance obligation just doesn't conceptually hang together at all with the notion of a right of use.
You want to come back on that, Richard, I guess.
Yeah, and I guess maybe this is just the part I'm missing, but if I understood the arguments for the lessee approach this morning, there was a difference between having the asset and having a right to use that asset. And that's why there would be something called the other than finance lease approach. And so, and then when I heard the amortization approaches other than the alternative proposed, it was based on the assumption that it wasn't the same as owning the asset. But the derecognition approach is the same as selling part of the asset. So I guess ultimately, if the point is just lessor accounting is going to be different than lessee accounting, fine. But if they're supposed to be applying similar principles, I don't get that disconnect. That's the part I'm missing in this proposal, in some of the proposals I'm hearing.
Do you want to come in straight away, Matt?
Yeah.
Okay, you may.
Maybe I can help. I mean, if an asset is a bundle of rights,
oh, I got
the right to use that asset within that certain period is part of that asset. So if you recognize that right of use for the lessee, of course the value or the part of that asset needs to be recognized by the lessor.
No, I understand that, and it's not fair to you because I think you advocated one lessee approach. My point is, if the lessor derecognized part of a fixed asset, didn't the lessee acquire part of a fixed asset? I know how to do it in financial instruments. I can strip it all apart and give somebody the interest rate strip and so on, and I don't say it's not a financial instrument for the buyer. It's part of it. So I'm just pointing out that's the part, as we had done different lessee-lessor approaches, that I don't understand, and I'm not sure I've heard a principle articulated for, which I think will be very important if we're going to use different models for lessees and lessors. That's all.
I think, Philippe, you wanted to come in.
Yeah, thank you. I wanted to get back to Mark. And so I assume for a while that the performance obligation model is off the table for a while. If the business model of the lessor says to invest in tower cranes, he buys 10 tower cranes, he leases them out for 1 year each, and the average life would be 20 years if he is properly maintained or overhauls the equipment. What's the benefit for you? And maybe put aside the beauty of mirror accounting between the lessor and the lessee and the consolidation automatic, if you put the two together, then they would offset automatically. But put the accounting argument aside. But in terms of business model, as compared to the current operating lease model that would apply to this lessor, what's, in your opinion, the benefit of a derecognition, a partial derecognition? So you would recognize each year 1/10 or 1/20 of that crane, of those cranes. What does it mean for the users of the financial statements?
Well, I struggle to answer that question if you say that the condition is that I have to set aside the accounting coherency of the answer, because why have derecognition? It's because the boards are asking lessees to recognize something. So, you know, and to me, that has not just been created out of thin air. It's come from somewhere. And so the guy who's given them that thing they're going to have to recognize needs to de-recognize it. If you were to say that the right accounting for a tower crane rental, if he's renting tower cranes out for 1 year and he's going to do that for the next 20 years, then, yeah, I mean, current operating lease accounting would work quite well for that sort of person. But I think it would actually work well for his customer as well.
Okay.
But that doesn't seem to be on the table anymore.
David?
First of all, I say I agree entirely with what Mark has been saying. I think there should be one model and it should be the derecognition. But I think part of the problem is from using the term derecognition. Because if I'm, say, a bank lessor, I will enter into that lease contract. I won't have had an asset at all beforehand, and I will buy the asset later. So what am I actually acquiring from entering into that contract? I'm acquiring a right to rentals and a residual interest in the asset. That is all I've acquired. So derecognition doesn't come into it. Those are the two elements I have actually acquired from that contract I've entered into. And if I'm a manufacturer dealer, I have this item in inventory. The question is, I've got to take it out of inventory and put it into something else. And again, what is that something else? PP&E is not necessarily the right answer. Because what I've got from what was in inventory, now I've got a right to rentals and a right to residual interest. And I also think the whole question about the distinction between what is an asset and what is right of use asset, again, I agree with what Thomas said, that your asset in the first place is under the definition of an asset, is effectively the rights to use that asset. The fact that you've got legal title is simply the legal means by which you obtain that right. Now, that's the fact that you obtain that right through obtaining legal title as opposed to through some other means shouldn't affect the accounting subsequently.
So how do you handle the circumstances that I think Mark identified, which some people say is problematic, so it's the real estate leases? And maybe there's shorter term.
I think the problem on real estate leases is the question of the profit recognition at the inception, and so whether you should recognise a huge profit up front. And I agree with Rich that one should limit the cases in where one recognises an initial profit. But that doesn't mean to say one still hasn't got two assets. So the two elements to it. What are the assets I've got to recognise? And the second is the revenue recognition issue.
Are you just defer the gain or something?
Yes. Bill?
Yeah, I don't really see the problem in lessee and lessor accounting. I think our concept now is that we're accounting for rights and obligations. And when the discussion we're having about lessee accounting is that we've capitalized those rights and obligations, the question we've been dealing with is how do we cost allocate? For those contracts that look like we've bought the asset, we may amortize the asset over the life of the contract and account for the liability. For those that are rentals, we may decide straight line is the right way to cost to allocate. But everything is on balance sheet because we've accounted for the acquisition of these rights of use. Now, on the lessor side, I think we do want to account for the rights that we've sold. As people have said, assets are a bundle of rights. And so we've sold the right of use. That right of use has a basis. And if there's a value that's been in fact, in the PV of the rents that's greater than the basis, the diminution of the value because we've transferred these rights, a gain should be recognized associated with that. Otherwise, we leave the unleased value or the residual on balance sheet. So I think from the lessee side, we're talking about cost allocation. From the lessor side, we are accounting for rights transferred, and we do want to try to determine what upfront profit, if any, should be recognized. So I don't see an inconsistency at all. And I've said it before that I think the derecognition should be the default model for any lease of one asset to one lessee for a term of greater than 1 year. that's in the case of real estate, you could apply derecognition, but I think as David was saying, it just gets too complicated. How can you tell what's the basis of the value that I transferred, especially if real estate values are increasing? I might have 100% gain recognition because there's no diminution of the value that I sold. I listened to the revenue recognition session on licensing agreements, and I think when there's no diminution of the value of what I'm transferring for a period of time, I should get 100% gain recognition. Where there is a diminution, then I only get partial gain recognition. So I don't really see a problem, because the cut we're trying to make on the lessee side is to allocate costs. We've capitalized the rights, and we should de-recognize those rights on the lessor side. And I do think we start to creep back into accounting for the underlying. And we should be accounting for the rights, not the underlying.
Okay. George? Can the staff kind of summarize what users said about the lessor model in the ED? I mean, we're sitting here trying to figure out what the lessor model should be. What are users saying? Do they want derecognition? Do they want a decreasing revenue stream over the life of the lease? I mean, what?
They did not like the exposure draft either, and their views, I can't say there's unanimous view amongst users, and Mary, I'm sure, will give his, but they were either saying there should be one model applied to all, and majority of who said that said there should be derecognition, which is along the lines of some of the comments we are hearing now. And then there was a group of users who were saying, we don't have any problems with following current accounting for lessors, and you know, you shouldn't change anything about that. We only want a little bit more transparency on the residual asset value, so we would like improvements in that area. But other than that, we don't have a problem with analyzing lessors' financial statements. David, is there anything else?
Yeah, I was going to add, Ada mentioned it at the end, residual, but that's the sort of focus I think we heard a lot from the analysts. You know, today, certainly with leases today that are classified as operating leases, they feel they don't get enough information around the residual piece. You do get that as a required extra set of disclosures on the finance lease side, so they're more comfortable where that is.
Yeah. I can ask Neri, and then I think Hal wants to come in. So.
I think there's two issues here. One is the balance sheet and the notion of the recognition and getting the residual on the balance sheet as to Mark's point as far as what's being sold. And also the comment that Rich earlier mentioned that you want symmetry. I think you can get symmetry from a conceptual standpoint. I can definitely see the asymmetry, if you will, from a practical standpoint, right? So conceptually, you say, I need to have one model. Conceptually, I'm where David is. You want to get my one model. You want to be consistent. And then you realize from a practical reason, you want to make some accommodations for lessee accounting, and you want to call some leases other than financing because it's easier. You get you reduce the cost, you minimize the cost, and you don't lose a lot of information. Then if you go back and say, oh, because I introduced this practical exception here, do I need to introduce it to the other end? I'm not sure that I'm there. So I can, you know, if you go through this entire conceptual loop, I'm not sure that I can see the symmetry because the practical accommodation could be selective. So if you ask for a principle, this would be my principle of why I can see this differential, if you will. Now, with respect to users, I think the main issue is once you get the residual and you get the balance sheet information, I think you cured for some elements with respect to users. But I think the other issue would be what would be the income recognition pattern. This is quite important. By changing the classification of the balance sheet, you will also change the income recognition. I don't know how much you penetrated those discussions with respect to users. Because by changing the income recognition for either one-time recognition on partial leases or changing what could be a financing type solely amortization with profit, which I'm not objectionable to, but I can definitely see those users say, okay, I'd like to see the straight line. Don't give me the lumpiness. But to your earlier point, I think users will conceptually find it
at least from my perspective, appropriate, especially for those financial lessors. It would make more sense. If you get to sales-type leases where you otherwise sell the assets in your business of selling the assets, and you could de-recognize and recognize part of the sales gain, if you will, even if you sold only parcel of the assets and you get some residual, I don't think users are going to be bothered by that. And frankly, I think they're going to get, in theory, somewhat of a better depiction if it's appropriately practiced.
Helen? Thanks.
Okay. I just wanted to explain a little bit, George, in your comment about users. I'm sitting here thinking about it. For simplicity's sake, let's split the user group into two big components, debt users, people who are providing financing of some sort, and then equity users. I could see each of those groups coming to different conclusions. I would think that the debt users of the financials would prefer to not derecognize, because what they're associating the debt with are hard assets on the balance sheet. But if you start derecognizing, doesn't some of that asset become, you start to separate it from the hard asset, if you will, and it becomes more of a financial asset. Whereas I would think that the equity users would be more, it would be a change of way of looking at it, but it wouldn't be as big a hurdle for them. So there, you may get some different answers, I would think, and I didn't know if you had talked to them in those contexts, splitting debt versus equity in terms of users.
Yeah, we have. It's been interesting. You know, I'll state the obvious here, but I think it's easier to get user feedback around the lessee side, because obviously there's so many companies that they're looking at that participate in lessee activities. When you get into the lessor business, it's sort of smaller pockets, so trying to get the visibility was probably tougher, I think it's fair to say, in our outreach in terms of feedback from the lessors.
Yeah. The point I really want to get across is that you've got two major user groups out there, and I would think they could easily come to very different conclusions on this. One more easily could get to an answer that you've proposed, whereas the debt users, I think, would have real trouble getting their personal view.
We did talk to real estate users, and they certainly want to see the assets on the books, and they don't want the interest income in the income statement. So we definitely heard that. George wants to add.
Did you want
to? Yeah, just to emphasize that, you know, you were up at the meeting. We had a meeting, and we took two major real estate investors with us, and I always like to quote the one. The one said, "You know what? If you apply this accounting to a major investment builder company, I'm never going to use it again. And what you're going to do," he said, "this is a lethal change in accounting, because what it's going to do is, instead of me starting with the 10K and 10Q, the audited reviewed numbers, and then going on with my analysis, I'm going to start with management's numbers." I mean, it was that bad. So I was just curious as to, now that's in real estate, and I was just wondering if that was the same reaction in other industries. That's why I asked the question. So all we need to do is get the right standard on, similar to IAS 40, and we'll be okay.
No. You seem to keep circling back on that one, don't you?
John?
Yes. I agree with many of the comments that were said before, but the new one I want to add is that when we're talking about what is a lease, we're starting to focus on control. Now, if you're dealing with a situation where the lessor has given up control of whatever, however you choose to define it, usually loss of control is regarded as an accounting event that gives rise to a certain bit of accounting to it. When the lease would end, that would mean that you're getting control back. Again, another accounting event that has another set of accounting consequences. I would urge the boards and the staff to think of the concept of control and what it means, particularly as they look at lessor accounting, because it may lead you to certain directions. My my heart tells me that in many cases it will lead you to situations that are more akin to derecognition when there isn't much going on, lead you to some other model like operating lease accounting when you're dealing with parts of an asset, real estate, significant services, or other things. The only other point to bring in here is that, you know, something Rich raised at the start, we still have yet to discuss the issue of contingent rents or variable rents, which has a significant bearing on how people will filter this information.
Thanks, John.
As I listen to the conversation, I have that sense of deja vu all over again. And the board members, both past and present, on the ISB and the FASB over the last 21 months or so since I've been listening to the conversation, who are advocates of the performance obligation approach, I know are concerned with this immediate recognition of profit. That is, I think, the major hurdle that they have. And some of them have that concern. It's embedded in, I think, both a theoretical and a legal analysis of what a lease is. And I had this conversation with Bill going back many months ago, and then subsequent conversations with other members of both the FASB and the ISB. When a piece of equipment is delivered by a lessor to a lessee, some view that a performance obligation has been discharged. A performance obligation has been settled. Others believe that that is not the case, that there's an ongoing performance obligation to make the underlying thing, other than, say, real estate, but we could even throw real estate in there, make it available. And this is a question which I asked you, and I chatted with my friend Tom Linsmeyer about. And there is a view that the lessee now has quiet enjoyment of this thing, and the lessor cannot disrupt that as long as they continue to make payments. And so a performance obligation has been settled. But other people say, no, the terms of these contracts are such that the only reason why or the only way they continue to have availability or access to this underlying thing is if the lessor makes it available to them. Now, that doesn't make sense to me that a lessor could just come along and take that thing back unless there's a violation of some provision in the lease. So in my mind, we have to come to grips with and wrestle that issue to the ground, because I believe there can be asymmetry in the accounting for lessor and lessee. Rich, you posed the question a while ago. I have not heard a principle for why a lessor can derecognize part of an asset, but then why a lessee would not recognize part of it. And I can think of one, and that is the lessor has the asset to start with. The lessee doesn't. Okay, there's asymmetry to start with. Okay, so if you actually have the physical thing, and as Mark said, you're giving up rights in that physical thing, it seems to my mind, irrespective of how you measure it, cost, fair value, something has been taken away from it, and that militates to some kind of derecognition event. But then the question is has a performance obligation been settled that would allow you to recognize profit? I don't know whether those are two separate events. The delivery of the asset, that's a performance obligation, and now we have profit associated with it that we want to defer. In the revenue recognition model, we're not deferring profit when we settle a performance obligation. So this is what I'm having trouble with, and maybe it varies by jurisdiction and the way a lease is written. Maybe in some cases when you deliver the thing, in fact, performance obligation is settled. But if we're going to say there's always this ongoing obligation to make the thing available, then there's never a settlement of the performance obligation until, you know, the expiry of the lease. So I this is what I'm having trouble wrestling with, and some people take the view that no, you have quiet enjoyment of it, subject to all the provisions of the lease, and others say no. You know, you talk to Tom, and he'll tell you no. There's ongoing performance obligations, and we should not, you know, ignore them, and therefore we shouldn't allow profit recognition. So in my mind, it comes down to sometimes a legal interpretation of what we're dealing with, not just an accounting discussion. Bill?
Oh, a lot of comments to make, so let me try to keep it short. One, to the comment about how the users use the financials, whether you're debt or equity. I think equity, obviously, the focus is going to be on EPS because that will drive your price. If the debt holders have security in the assets, they'll want to know they still have security. I don't think they care about the type of assets. Their focus is really going to be more on cash flow and where is it in the cash flow statement and what's driving either free cash flow or fixed charge ratio. If you try to take the issues that we're talking about today and decision flow them down, the first one we're trying to, and I think we're making progress, what's a lease versus what's an executory or service contract? We seem to be making progress there on specific or specified assets. So then drop into lessee or lessor, two parties to the contract, with the proviso that we want to use a right-of-use model. If you're going to say, I'm going to use the right-of-use model for all leases, then from a lessee perspective, your differentiation then becomes, do I really have a financing, in which case I ought to reflect the financing in my P&L, and if I don't, then reflect some form of straight line in your P&L. That seems to be logical, because if you're going to say, I'm using the right-of-use asset, then you've purchased something, at least putting it on your balance sheet. I think the interest and depreciation is the more logical answer. I think the straight line is an accommodation that we don't want to screw up all the users. And it's not illogical because typically those are shorter leases and more rental in nature. From a lessor side, I honestly tend to agree with Mark and others. If a lessee is buying something, a lessor should derecognize. I mean, the definition of an asset is the rights to the future cash flow. So you've sold the rights, you ought to be able to recognize a gain. Then the asset that you have becomes a financial instrument, a lease receivable. Now, inherent in that, if you're trying at some point to make economics match accounting, you know, that's a new concept, but that is the objective, then I think you need to address residual interest, and it needs to be at fair value. Otherwise, the two will never match. Do you want to make an accommodation to say, because I'm accommodating lessees with rental leases in their P&L, I'm not going to come back to lessor and say I'll treat them differently? I guess you could get there. I'm not certain it makes a lot of logic. But there are a lot of lessors that operate as rentors. So if their business model is to rent, maybe you use a differentiator in lessors as the business model. I'm not certain that you have to have the same differentiators between a lessor and a lessee, because I think we've agreed the accounting, as Larry points out, doesn't have to be consolidated worldwide financials. And then I hope the FASB gets to keep George happy and do IAS 40, because that would solve the problem of very long-lived assets. I mean, it's a similar in the aircraft business. You got long-lived assets. Would those be most appropriately addressed in that standard? Anyway, just a few thoughts. I think we're making progress. I think we need to bifurcate the differentiators for a lessor and a lessee. But honestly, I think if you've decided the right-of-use model is what you're going to use, then derecognition for a lessor makes sense.
And Bill, from a lessor perspective, and you make the cut wherever, you use business model as the driver perhaps, then if it's not derecognition, you would be using just an operating lease approach, the current operating lease?
I think inherent in the business model, Warren, is if you're going to say I'm not going to respect derecognition, I want to look for something else to differentiate, then what are you looking to? You're looking to have I transferred the risks and rewards related to that underlying asset. And if you haven't, then you're probably in a rental. And if you have, you're in...
Right. It's not a poor performance obligation approach you're promoting in those circumstances. It's an operating lease type. No.
The performance obligation approach, what is that? I guess it's consistent with the revenue recognition standard. So you'd in essence say a rental lease is like a service contract, a service or a long-term service contract in the revenue recognition model. It's got some challenges in implementing it because you've got to track new items. And I think it ignores the fact that if you've indeed if the lessees indeed purchased a right, a lessor should have sold something. I mean, an asset is the rights to future cash flow. Once you've given a lessee a lease, you've given up the rights to the cash flow directly from that asset and substituted them for a receivable, which is another asset.
Okay. You guys had your lights on down there?
Yeah, I wanted to mention, to talk a little bit more about what Pat said. I do think that the FASB needs a legal opinion on quiet enjoyment. I had sent an email to the board, not that I'm a lawyer, but I did some research on it. And in the U.S., quiet enjoyment is usually explicit in a contract, but if it's not, the courts will recognize it as an implied right. I would question whether or not a lease that has a performance obligation should be capitalized by the lessee at all. I don't think it's a lease. Another point, when we talk about gain recognition, remember, we're just recognizing the gain on the right of use transferred. There's also the recognition of finance income over the life. So it's not that there's an immediate gain recognition. It's only the difference between the value of the PV of the rents and the value of the value of the ROU transfer that gets recognized immediately. The other portion of the gain gets recognized as finance income. And to talk about whether or not current lessor accounting is broken or not. In my experience with third-party lessors, the only thing that they felt that was wrong with current lease accounting was the arbitrariness of classifying a lease as a finance lease or a direct finance lease or an operating lease because, as Mark has been talking about, their business model, the companies that I worked for, were that they did leases that transferred the right of use and they retained a residual. And they felt that direct finance leasing was appropriate, except that there was a bright line and some leases fell on the other side of it. So I would think that applying derecognition as the default model solves the one problem that my experience, at least with the companies that I worked for, that they viewed as the major problem, was that their leases weren't operating leases. The operating leases, I think, are, as Mark was saying, if you look at the business model and I buy an asset and I lease it on a short-term basis, my pricing has some finance element, as all leases do, but most of it has to do with market risk and what the market will bear. Hertz charges a different rate for a car in Las Vegas than in Des Moines, Iowa. A lot of it is just because of supply and demand, and the one in Las Vegas, they may lease it twice a day. In Des Moines, it might sit on the lot for a while, and they charge a different rate. There, the stock and trade is the asset. It should be depreciated. And the revenue is the rental revenue. But if there's any kind of term to the lease, it's usually priced as a financing, at least in my experience in the equipment leasing market.
Thanks, Bill. Did you want to come back, Bill?
Yeah, I want to come back. I forgot. I think Linsmeyer has raised the point that there are remaining performance obligations once you deliver the underlying in a lease. I really like to understand that as a lessor. Once you deliver the asset, assuming quiet enjoyment's in the lease, either implicitly or explicitly, but there aren't any typically continuing obligations. And really, if you think there's a continuing obligation, it's what your action may be if you don't get paid. And if you think about that for a moment, then in essence what you're doing is crystallizing the credit risk and the receivable, which you're covering in the accounting, either subsequent, initial or subsequent, of the lease receivable. But there aren't any ongoing performance obligations. And there's actually a mechanism in place worldwide that covers rolling stock, and it's called the Cape Town Treaty. And the idea of the Cape Town Treaty was to take the Anglo and the U.S. principles relating to how does a finance or repossess an asset and expand that to anybody that finance or leases rolling stock. Rolling stock is anything that moves or flies. They don't treat it any differently if it's a financing versus a lease. You've got the same rights in the event of a default or non-performance. And what they're trying to do is say legally and economically, if somebody doesn't pay you, you're protected. You can go get your asset. To me, in my economically, then what that means is I've given somebody the right to use the asset for a while. They have to pay, certainly, but there's no performance obligation I have to make them pay. I have a remedy if they don't, but I don't have a performance obligation to do something more other than wait for their payments to come in.
Tom isn't here to explain himself, but I know part of Tom's concern, I think part of Tom's concern is where you've got integral services associated with the lease, a strong connection between the right to use the asset and the associated services that enable you to use the asset in the manner that you intend, and particularly in the context of property leases. I think that's a concern of some people who would support a performance obligation approach. Sorry, I'll put you back on.
No, that's fine. I understand that argument. I guess I would say if you have a service that you consider either significant to or a component of the lease that you should recognize, I think we're trying to address that by segregating them and accounting for the services separately as a service under the revenue recognition standard, which I think is then where you pick up your performance obligation. But to say it's necessarily part of the lease obligation itself, I'm not certain is necessarily valid, putting aside real property.
David?
Yes, a few things just on what been discussed. First of all, picking up on Bill's point, I say that the current lessor accounting is not broken. There are certainly plenty of UK lessors who were not write operating leases because of the accounting, the main problem being that you end up with losses. They see it as a financing type transaction, but they end up with significant losses in the early period and therefore won't write operating leases because of the straight line income recognition. So I think, you know, where the business model is financing, even though there is some residual value risk, then I think some sort of form of interest income ought to be recognised. Picking up on Pat's point about saying, well, that there is a difference between the lessee, and that the lessor has got physical access of physical, physically holds the asset at the beginning of the lease. That's not necessarily true. I mean, in many leases, the asset is delivered straight from the supplier to the customer. The lessor never has physical access to the asset at any time. And probably the end of the lease is probably sold by the lessee as well as agent for the lessor. So,
who has title? Yeah.
Title's just the legal means by which one obtains rights. It isn't something of value in its own right. You may obtain something through title. You may obtain it through a lease. You may obtain it through some other basis. Land, for example, you never have title to. You have a freehold interest. Title belongs to the state, legally.
Yeah. Okay, we can talk about that for a while, and may.
Yeah, I know.
But we'll end up talking about tax benefits.
No, but the point is, title is simply the legal means by which you obtain the rights. It isn't a value or right in its own, on its own. It's what the asset is, the rights which that title gives you, not the fact you got title. And one other aspect is on the user position. I would have thought what many users want to see is what residual value risk one's got and what credit risk one has got. And therefore, by showing it as two assets, a residual interest and a financial asset, one is giving that information of what risks that company has.
Thanks, David. Mark?
Yeah, I just wanted to come back on a couple of points around performance obligation and revenue recognition and so on, because I think there are a lot of frictions which appear in board discussions that I listen to around why one needs performance obligation, because derecognition generates upfront revenue. Derecognition, in the case of any bank-owned or third-party type lessor, derecognition is not synonymous with taking upfront revenue. And I think that has to be understood by all the board members, because a third-party lessor basically buys an asset and leases it in the same instance to his lessee. And as David says, he may never even take possession of it. It may go straight from the supplier to the lessee. And the way you price a third-party lease is you know how much you're paying for it, you know what residual value you're prepared to put on it, you know what interest rate you got, and you work out a rent. And when you discount all that back, there is no margin there for no upfront revenue for the third-party lessor to recognize. He is making a financial margin which will come through month after month over the life of the lease. And that is how third-party leases work. And you have to know that, because this notion that lessors can take upfront revenue and that's worrying and concerning is something that has colored, I think, the board debates for the last 2 or 3 years. And it is simply a misapprehension of how third-party lessors do their business. Now, there are other sorts of lessors where derecognition would allow them to take revenue upfront. And these are people who have manufactured something and are then putting it out on lease. But the income that they would recognize in that case is basically their manufacturing margin, i.e. the difference between what it cost them to build the object and its arm's-length sales price, the price at which they would sell it, for example, to a third-party lessor. If they choose not to sell it to a third-party lessor but to lease it themselves, they would be shooting themselves in the foot to lease it out at a rent which was any different from that which a third-party lessor would charge, because otherwise they would be giving away part of their manufacturing margin. So I don't see what would be reprehensible in the eyes of the boards about someone who has just manufactured something recognizing some upfront revenue that he would have got anyway if he had sold it to a dealer or to a third-party lessor. So I really think that this thing about derecognition generating upfront revenue, and that's worrying, and therefore we need to invent the concept of performance obligation so that we spread revenue, is a misapprehension of how leasing actually works at the beginning.
What about property leases, Dave? What about the? It's not. I don't agree with Bill on it. I don't think it's such an issue on day one, assuming that you've just acquired a property and then you on lease it.
Mm-hmm.
I think when you release, you've got the issue because you've got an embedded gain that hasn't been recognised.
It depends what you do with the residual.
If you accrete the residual up, yes, you won't have that problem.
Exactly.
You'll have a...
Yeah. We've always said you should accrete residuals up to where you think...
That's how you deal with that.
Yeah. And then the second thing I wanted to say is that Pat has said about performance obligation, there's people who have a view that there's quiet enjoyment and other people don't have that view. But quiet enjoyment is not a view. It's a fact. It's a legal obligation. You can't just say, oh, well, I don't see it that way. It exists. It's, as a lessor, you have to provide the object in question to the lessee, and then you have to leave him quiet enjoyment, provided he respects his side of the executory contract, which is to pay his rent as it falls due. So you can't just say, I don't have a view about quiet enjoyment. I don't think I agree with that. That's just denying the facts of the agreement. And then the notion of these performance obligations which are so integrally entwined in the lease that you can't get rid of, take them out and separate them. Again, I think, I'm sorry to say, but it's a pity that Mr. Lindensmar is not here, but I think that's just a figment of someone's imagination. I just don't see the situation where, as the owner of an asset, you are going to lease it to somebody and at a fixed price, and then accept that you have some sort of other performance obligation in there that's so inseparable that you can't split it out and price it and get someone else to cover it. I mean, you're taking a sort of unlimited risk on this thing. And to be honest, it just doesn't exist. The examples that are given in terms of property are, there's this floor, but for this floor to be accessible, the elevators need to work, or maybe this floor is easy enough, but the 10th floor, the elevators need to work. But in property leases, there are two things. There's the lease of the space itself, and then there are service charges. And in any case, the fact of having working elevators is not something that the owner of the property deals with. He outsources that to somebody. There are companies that are very good at building and maintaining lifts and making sure that they work. And so it's clearly a perfectly separable service, and it should be bifurcated out of the lease. So I just don't live with the concept of these completely entwined services which are inseparable and which serve, therefore, to justify the existence of an ongoing performance obligation, because I think it's a concept that's just invented. It's self-serving. It serves to try and justify the performance obligation notion. Nobody's ever been able to show me one of those that is not separable. It's a service contract.
Rich?
Yeah, just 2 points. The first, I guess, is a question. I heard the other than finance lease model for lessees described as a practical accommodation. Is that really what it is, or is it really the board's changing the model to deal with what they perceived as better information to provide to users? Because I view those as two very different things. A practical accommodation, in my mind, is we know what the answer is, but we're not going to do it to make it easier on someone. I didn't think that's what the on-balance sheet other than finance lease model was proposed to be. Maybe it is. And depending on how you answer that question would probably dictate how comfortable you are with applying a similar model to lessors or not. If it's really, as Neri says, just a practical accommodation to make it easier, then, you know, you can always have exceptions and do that wherever you want. So that first is an observation / question, and maybe I misunderstood where the boards were on that. The other is we've talked a lot about upfront gain recognition on derecognition. What about upfront loss recognition? And what about changes to the impairment model to deal with that? I'll give you an example, and this may be your segue to get you back onto the 2 o'clock schedule. If you have a lease, if you have a lease with significant variable lease payments, then there, chances are, unless you simply say derecognition is equal to the lesser, I guess you'd have to limit it to the amount of the lease receivable booked. Otherwise, in that case, you very well could have a loss, because it may be the lessor is looking for some recovery of their investment through that variable payment. So I guess under the derecognition model, I would ask, you know, is there loss recognition up front, or is there an exception? It can only be a good guy. And if it can only be a good guy, then do you have another model for impairment that I can use on assets that I know will be leased? Because right now, a lessor tends to impair a fleet as a whole. They don't tend to impair it on an individual asset basis, at least under U.S. GAAP. Okay. So do we want to change that to be, no, not only do you impair it on an asset basis, but it's on a right-of-use basis, and it's a marketable, theoretical right-of-use basis that you want to extend impairment to, all of which I assume would be somewhat problematic.
Yeah, it's a good point. If you just apply the derecognition model and you end up in a situation where you're not recovering the value of what you've transferred, yeah, you would have a day one loss. And it does bring into sharp focus this question of variable lease payments. It's a fair point.
It does.
I think on the other one, I don't think it's a practical accommodation. The short-term lease decision is a practical accommodation.
That's what I thought.
The other is endeavouring to be responsive to what we've heard from users, that they want to see, let's call it a straight-line P&L pattern, that they don't find the P&L pattern when you apply finance lease accounting in the context of those types of rental arrangements to be particularly informative and reflective of what's going on.
I think
some of them see it as being perhaps closer to sort of a cash flow notion as well.
And then I guess my question is, if you start looking at, and I know John's company has some subs that do this, these companies that lease out, be it rail cars or cargo containers, you know, they're quoted at a daily rate, and might be you take 500 on, and you can't drop off more than 25 a quarter for the next 4 years. I'm curious what the analysts think is better on that side, if they think more of a straight line recognition approach is better than an upfront income approach that we get on the derecognition type model. I don't know, but I think it's a subset of lessors that you'd want to look at, and you may hear the exact same thing you heard about the users of those lessee financials.
Okay, we're happy to keep discussion going for a little longer. So, Kevin?
Just following on from what Mark was saying, in the papers that were handed out, part of the thing was this discount rate. And I didn't understand why the board would conclude, which again gets back to this upfront profit recognition, why the lessor could use the rate, the lessor charged the lessee, or the lessee's incremental borrowing rate, or the yield on the property. If there's one thing the lessor always knows, it's the incremental rate, V that he's charged the lessor, the lessee. He always knows the incremental rate of the contract because he knows what his outflow was and he knows what his future cash flows are. Why, if we come to one rate, there's no profit recognition because it's always going to be discounted. It's tick and move on.
I'm trying to remember.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's said there's three options, and the lessor gets three options. It's like, why?
Oh, I know. Yeah, I'm trying to.
I think
the rationale is.
It's illogical.
It's feeling, but
I think we came up with that
practical
on the fly.
Yeah.
I don't know if I really feel comfortable with some of the discount rates.
Real estate lessors don't have an interest rate.
Charge
right.
Oh, okay, that's what it was.
And I think the tentative decision wording did say that when more than one indicator of the rate is available to the lessor, you would use the implicit rate.
Yes, but it seemed like it would always be the implicit rate, because even for the yield that the guy's issued his property on, is still the rate implicit.
Well, it's because to get the implicit, you use the fair value of the residual.
And he set the rate, yeah.
But they don't price them using that.
Yeah, well, still a yield.
We'll go back and have a look at that and make sure we think it's defensible. If not, we might go up something else. But, yeah, I'd forgotten that was the reason. John, did you want to come?
I just wanted to, you know, close out Richard's comment. You know, with regards to, like, the rail car, you know, shorter-term leases, not familiar with what the analysts want there, though echoing what was said before, the primary focus tends to be what's the credit risk, what's the residual risk that exists with regards to assets under lease.
And,
sure.
I listened to what Mark said, and I'm very empathetic to that. I find it very hard to argue with your logic on any of the points that you opened up with, as well as your expansion on my question. So I guess the issue in my mind for the board is, if that is in fact the case, that setting aside other types of services that may be bundled with the real estate or the underlying piece of equipment, if in fact once it's delivered by a lessor to a lessee, just as an owner of a license may deliver a license to a licensee, if that action is the culmination of the satisfaction of a performance obligation, that in my mind, if we're going to follow the same path as we're developing for RevRec, should result in the culmination of the recognition of revenue and profit. And I think those who want to support a performance obligation have to put forth compelling arguments, both not just from an accounting standpoint, but from the standpoint of what the contracts say. If we're accounting for the contract says you now have to give that lessee the quiet enjoyment. It seems as if they have control within the context of a lease, not the context of ownership. But in the context of a lease, they have quiet enjoyment of that. That would seem to militate towards, you know, derecognition by the lessor. And I find it really hard to argue with that, notwithstanding, you know, the endless hours of debate that we've heard on the subject. So if we still have a performance obligation model at the end of all this discussion, I personally would be somewhat disappointed.
Warren Addis.
I don't know. I guess Larry, ask Russ, ask anybody to jump in here. What am I missing? What am I not getting?
Well, I had a clarification point of Mark. Take Bill Solomon's company, manufacturer and lessor. If he leases an aircraft for 5 years versus an aircraft for 20 years, is he getting the same profit as if he sold it, or are you going to do a smaller profit for the 5 year and then you're in the 20 year? Because I heard you say you give him the same profit irrespective of the lease term. That's why I'm asking my clarification question.
Can Bill's company answer Bill the question and then Mark can defend his position?
We don't mind a bit of coalescing.
I think if you structured a transaction where you, in essence, transferred all the risk, you'd recognize the full manufacturing profit. Simplistically, because if you're going to account for the fair value of the receivable and compare it to the base of the underlying asset, the receivable will be larger. if you had a shorter lease, the receipt would be smaller. You wouldn't be recognizing as much profit. I think logically that's the way it would work. I think it would be a little bit ludicrous to assume, worst case, I can sell an aircraft to Airline X and sign them up to a one-year lease and take full profit. That doesn't make sense. I don't think you've accomplished your profit economically.
I agree, but I didn't hear you say that, Mark.
No, you're right. I didn't quite say that. And the reason why is because, I mean, intellectually, I have actually some sympathy with the viewpoint that if Bill, once he'd finished building his airplane, can either himself put it on lease for, five years out of the 20 with an airline, or he can go and see John, who would probably be delighted to put it on lease for the same 5 years, for the same rental to the same airline, why would he get different profit recognition treatment in those two situations? If he went to John, he'd sell the plane to John, John would put it on lease, Bill would get full profit recognition. If Bill does the deal himself, he would get 5/20 of his manufacturing profit or something like that. I mean, I can live with that logic, but at the end of the day, what's that different about it?
Well, where you make up the difference is, okay, then how do you account for the residual on a subsequent basis?
Right.
If you're going to fair value, which is appropriate because that reflects economics, then you'd catch it up.
That was a practical accommodation.
No. The whole reason for arguing fair value accounting of a residual in a lease is it's the only way you get the economics to match the accounting. Over the term, assuming no impairment, no default, no restructuring, if you go with the allocated amount to residual interest as opposed to fair value, you never met. You walk to the end and you've got to do a difference accounting. You should do a difference accounting somehow. Otherwise, all you're doing is deferring a larger gain to the end of the lease for the next release. That's not the economics. When you look and price a lease with a customer, you're pricing value at the end, value at the beginning, credit risk, what your target yield is, and part of your risk is the up and down expected value and the residual. If you account for the residual interest at an allocated amount, which was the original proposal under derecognition, it doesn't make any economic sense.
But if you initially measure your residual at fair value, isn't that the same as recognizing full profit? And like you are recognizing full profit,
yeah,
regardless of the length of the lease.
Right.
That's true. You end up in that situation, which did worry some people. Bill, you wanted to make a comment?
I think in Bill's example and Mark's example where Bill said he could sell the plane to John at GE, or he could lease the plane to someone for 5 years, and GE could sell the plane for 5 years. Should he get different profit recognition? I think he should. In the case of him selling the plane to GE, he sold the right of use and the right of ownership. He sold everything. He gets full profit. If instead he leased it for 5 years to an airline, he should only get to recognize the difference between the present value of the rents and the value that diminished on his books for having transferred the right. And I think that's what the partial derecognition model says.
Yes.
I think that's right. As opposed to today's gap, he would have to have a direct finance lease, and he doesn't because he only sold 5 years' worth. And so under today's model, you could get a 100% gain recognition if you sold 90% of the value, but we've moved away from that model.
In your example, if I could just jump in.
The lessee guarantees the residual value at the end of the 5 years. Do you still think you should have different answers?
No. Earlier today, I said that if you look at the I don't think so.
Okay, so in that circumstance, you would say they should be the same.
Well, I said earlier that if you look at leases, looking at it from a lessee's perspective, I said I think we have finance leases and we have rental contracts. And the finance leases, in order to determine when have we sold the underlying, let's look at the residual position. Did we transfer the asset? Is there a bargain purchase option? Or in the terms, is there some kind of residual guarantee, profit sharing? Those are the kinds of indicators, I think, that indicate from a lessee perspective that I should have a different cost allocation model than if I'm just renting. And from the lessor perspective, likewise, I think you should look at it the same way. If you've guaranteed, if the residual is guaranteed and they're obligated to make rent payments, gee, I think you've sold it. And I think you should get 100% profit recognition.
For just a moment, because something I think I addressed earlier and may have been slightly overlooked. So you brought up a lessee guaranteeing residual value. What I think has been ignored in lease transactions is there's often a third party guaranteeing the residual value. And it's inherent to whether a lessor will actually lease the asset to the lessee or arrange the financing. And if I remember the preliminary indicative guidance so far, we're going to exclude that. So let me use an example sort of to highlight the situation, which is the case, especially in some of the arrangements with third-party banks. If an airline uses a bank to arrange lease financing, for example, in Germany, most of the German banks will want a third-party guarantee of the residual value at the end. And under what I think I believe has been proposed so far, that would be excluded from the consideration as to how to account for the lease. If you have a residual value guarantee that's arranged with a third party that's directly related to the lease contract, the economics of the transaction should include that third party arrangement and be considered. And I, at the risk of trying to revisit old history, I just wonder if somebody has walked by that inadvertently. And it needs to be considered because.
Why, Bill? Why?
Because the lessor won't do the lease without it, or the bank.
Why won't the lessor do the?
Because it wants to know that it doesn't have risk at the end of the lease, so it will not take the residual interest risk. And absent the provision of a third party guarantee, it won't do the transaction.
In other words, he wants the economics of sales.
Right.
Yeah.
No. So there are third-party companies that specialize in providing residual value guarantees on leases.
Just as a financing transaction. What we've heard in the U.S. Mm-hmm. is the reason those are there
are so the lessor can get direct financing lease and the lessee can get operating lease. It may be the case.
It's
a non-substantive accounting. You're saying there's actual real economics to the third-party lessor.
Absolutely.
Residual guarantee.
There's different insurance. I mean, there's companies that sell that 1% insurance.
Yeah.
I mean, that's different than what Bill's talking about.
Okay.
Larry, do you want to come in on that?
Yeah. Call that first loss.
Can I, in order to better potentially get to Pat Finnegan's promised land in terms of where we end up, I need to understand a few things. If you take, let's assume you have a manufacturer who's going to be leasing it, and sometimes they sell it, sometimes they lease. And let's just say they normally sell it for $20, and the cost basis is $12, so they would normally have an $8 gain. But yet they're going to enter into a lease transaction for, let's say, about a quarter of the life. So theoretically, if you do the cost allocation, et cetera, you'll get $2 profit, a quarter of the expected manufacturer's profit. What are you going to do with the residual value then? Up until, you know, the end of the lease term?
Well, if we're going to go with a derecognition approach, and a part of that is recording the residual interest at its fair value, then presumably what you do is look to the end of the lease, find the fair value of the residual at the end of the lease, discount it back at time value money.
So effectively, you're going to get all of the manufacturer's profit then during the lease term. Is my understanding correct or not?
There is still a part of the profit in the residual value. That profit within, which is included in the residual value, you recognize after the lease term.
No, but I thought you said you're going to accrete the residual value up to the fair value.
It gets back to, well, how are you going to account for the residual value?
That's what I want to know.
If we get the fair value, then why would you not recognize it?
What?
What's the fair value? Is the fair value the exit price, meaning if you could sell it for $20 day one and at the end of 2 years you could sell it for $14?
Right.
You would have 100% profit in that transaction, but if it's a rapidly depreciating asset, say down to $8, you'd...
I think it would be the so... You have to be able to sell the asset, number one.
Right.
The only time you can do that is at the end of the lease.
Right. And it would be your selling price, right?
So it would be your selling price then. Then you'd have to discount it back for time.
It's your exit price today based on being able to access that value at the end of the lease term. It's an exit price notion. Now, you might calculate
it. But it's an exit price at the end of the lease.
Yeah, you might calculate it in that way in estimating what it is in the future to generate. But it's an exit price today. And all they're saying is you work that out on day one, and if you've got a difference between the remaining residual value carrying amount that you haven't transferred and its exit price, you'd recognise that at that point in time on day one or at the end of the first reporting period, and then you just accrete that every period on a exit value basis, remeasure it every period.
But you'll get different profits depending on how rapidly the asset deteriorates in the market.
I haven't done the math, but in my mind, if the selling price went down ratably with the life, okay, on a straight line basis, it just seems to me like you'd be recognizing the full manufacturer's profit during that lease term, and that is bothersome to me because you haven't sold the asset.
That's right.
Have partially recognition of the cost. You recognize some of that manufacturer's profit at the very end when you actually sold the asset, and on the condition that you sold it for the residual that you incorporated in calculations. Well, that was the way I understood what you put in the exposure draft.
That was why we ended up where we did. It was a concern that Larry mentioned. And some were concerned about that because you then had sort of the lumpiness involved with recognising that lump when you then released.
Well, you added more lumpiness into it by freezing the residual. That made it even lumpier.
That's right, yeah.
Someone focused on short-term profits would enter into a lot of short-term leases.
Yeah,
absolutely.
But fair value is not the only option, right? We can also create the residual, which in manufacturer dealer's case would bring your end value equivalent to your cost basis at the end of the lease, so that part of the profits that relates to the residual would not be recognized, which may be more palatable, but you would not realize it then until you have sold that remaining rights. So the two approaches.
That's another option.
Okay. We need to move on, but John, last word from you.
Observation to remind people that fair valuing residuals and doing away with sales type lease accounting did happen in the U.S. in the 60s and then was undone a mere 10 years later after the fact. So it is always interesting that we're having a debate that originally occurred close to 50 years ago.
The line of accounting.
Yeah.
Okay. Before we move on to the next issue, I'd just like to ask a question. I think it came up earlier today about one or both chairmen of the boards making a comment that the lessor accounting model isn't broken at the moment, so why don't we pretty much leave that intact and just really focus our energies on lessee accounting. Is there anybody amongst the working group that believes that the lessor accounting model isn't really broken and that we shouldn't really be spending time on the lessor accounting model? Thomas?
I think conceptually I'm very much with Mike Venus. It doesn't make sense to have another concept for lessee accounting than for lessor accounting. But if we now think about a new invention of a dividing line between operating and finance lease, I would rather stick to the old one because I don't see any benefit an alternative dividing line. Maybe adjust a little bit the 90% rule or the alternative IFRS definition, but in basic I would stay with the current definition if there is not the option of having one model which is consistent to the right of use model.
Thank you. Rich?
I guess it depends on what it means that leave it alone. I think if you throw out new definitions of lease term, lease payments, and only apply them to lessees and not lessors, that would be very confusing. If, on the other hand, you say a model where you recognize sometimes profit up front, sometimes profit on a financing model, and sometimes profit straight line under an operating lease model, I understand that. But that's at the point where I would look back at what the proposal is, and you may find it's very similar to today's GAAP, simply making a journal entry at the end of the month for operating leases. And it seems like we did a lot to get to that. That's just an observation. In other words, if you take today's GAAP and just make a journal entry for lessees and lessors for their operating lease commitment, put it on balance sheet each quarter end, do we get effectively to the same answer that we're getting to? And that might be fine, but that's kind of where we're going.
Okay. John? I'm supportive of what Mark's views. My primary concern, if I look at the future and the future includes performance obligation and derecognition as it's proposed, I prefer what exists today to those proposals that are there. So it depends on what my alternatives are.
I understand. And David, Bill?
I think the problem is we look at back-to-back leases. If you don't fix one, you're going to get some very strange answers.
I think that the I said earlier the only thing that I think was wrong with today's accounting is that operating lease accounting was applied to leases that should have been direct finance leases, and I think with the concept of transfer of accounting for the rights of use, I think that we should have fewer operating leases, and as Mark had said, they should only apply to people who are actually in the operating lease business, where the stock and trade is the equipment. So really, today's accounting is almost right there, except now that we've changed the concept of not accounting for the underlying, we should apply derecognition and just keep operating lease accounting for either real estate or short-term leases where it's the stock and trade.
Okay, thanks very much for that discussion. And we're going to talk about variable lease payments now. Who's teeing that up?
I will.
Okay.
Thank you.
Go for it.
As most of you know, the board's tentatively decided